Hello and welcome everybody to our second podcast, Let's Talk About Death. I'm joined today by Dr. Katie Maloney and my name is Nick Davis. I am a soul midwife, so I provide emotional, psychological and spiritual support to people as they move towards the end of life. In the same way that a midwife brings a soul into this world, my role is to help a soul depart this world and to support people have the most peaceful death that they're able. Katie has been a GP for more than 17 years with a specialist interest in palliative care. And Katie has also been my GP for many, many years. She's smiling as she looks at me. And it is rather lovely that over the years with the conversations we've had, we've been able to come together to record this podcast, Let's Talk About Death. So why do we want to invite you to have this difficult conversation? Well, it is the subject that very few people want to talk about. Even the medical profession can struggle because it's the sum of all of our fears, the saddest of sad things, and also the most unavoidable human experience of all. So finding ways to support and walk alongside those facing end of life has to be really within the grasp of us all. It's not reserved for those with years of medical or professional training, because death is first and foremost a human event. And as such, we all have a part to play in comforting our grieving soulmates and developing our own relationship and conversation with death. It really is the only way that Katie and I have found we can find to alleviate as much as possible our fear and anxiety surrounding death, is to really get to know it better, to understand it better, which is really the opposite of what we do right now. And so we'd like to ask you all to join this conversation to enable us to understand the process, to answer the questions that keep people awake at night, to share our experiences and stories of what people need, what helps, what does not, and ultimately how we can support ourselves and others as we face the reality of all of our mortality. So tonight's episode is going to focus very much on healing versus cure. And what do we mean by that? How can we interpret that? How can we understand that better to help us on our journey with death? But before we dive into that conversation in the detail, I'd just like to pass over to Katie to say hello.
Hello, Katie Maloney, GP here. And as Nick said, yes, I do have the pleasure of having been her GP, so I make no apologies for that. But it does mean over the years we've had a lot of conversations about death and dying, and that's what led to this podcast, really. And conversations that we found healing and uplifting, even. And I don't think uplifting is a word that people would associate with death and dying. To the point where when I went to do my placement as a junior doctor in a hospice, the number of people that said to me before I started work in that hospice, oh, that's going to be hard. Oh, that'll be really depressing. And then when I started, the first thing they said when I said I'm working in a hospice was this sort of look of pity on their faces. They sort of went, oh dear, oh, I bet that's hard. And it couldn't have been further from the truth. My experience working there was completely different to what I was expecting it to be as well. It was a happy, uplifting time. It was one of the happiest jobs I did. And I think that's what sort of led to this podcast, is sort of saying, actually, it's not something we need to fear. We can embrace it. We can find joy and peace with it. And that's what I experienced in the hospice. And it's just trying to spread that a bit so that I think people know that it's okay to talk about it.
Yeah, and I think that's quite interesting, because I think the number of times I have heard people actually apologise to me for mentioning the death, or saying, oh, I'm getting sad, or I'm being miserable, or I must lift the mood. And actually, I think it's really important to allow people the space to actually feel all of the emotions that they need to feel, good, bad, happy, sad, indifferent, whatever it is. And this is really what got Katie and I thinking about healing versus cure. So I think a bit of context might help here. So I saw Katie the other week, and I've been reading a book, and it's a book by Gabor Mate, who's a US physician, and he does a lot of work around trauma and healing. And actually, he's done an awful lot of work in palliative care. And some of his research and insights are just really, really inspiring and really made me pause for thought. And he draws a very clear distinction between cure, you know, he's medically trained, he's a physician, and healing. Now, we cannot cure everything. We know that, you know, science and medicine has its limits. And people do die, whether it's from an acute life-limiting illness or from old age, because we're human beings. Science and medicine can only go so far. So cure is a fix. It is a finite journey that we go on. But he argues that healing is not, and that healing is something that can go on. And actually, the paradox is in death, he can actually see people healing more than they have before they were actually told they were dying, because at an emotional and deep psychological level, they're doing an awful lot of healing. And that the legacy left with the people left behind, the loved ones, can be enormous. The ripple effects of seeing somebody heal the wounds and the traumas, the decisions, the regrets, all kinds of things, can leave families and loved ones with a level of peace and contentment, which is really very inspiring to see. And it really got me thinking, Megan. I thought, you know, based on the work that I do, there's something really fundamental in there, because almost as the body is starting to withdraw and to close down, you know, we're eating less, we're sleeping more, we are starting to interact far less in what, you know, we view as a full human life. We assume that that is the end and there's nothing else. But actually, and it's one of the things, and it only just come to me now as I'm talking, that I observed massively with my lovely brother-in-law, who sadly passed a few years ago from motor neuron disease. Now, obviously, that is, you know, that is a challenging disease by anybody's standards. It is not easy. But one of the things that I think, you know, everybody teaches us, he was a great teacher of, was how his, on one hand, his body was, you know, doing less. He was losing his motor neuron senses and so forth. But on the other hand, his mind was just expanding. You know, he was reading, and we would talk about things we hadn't talked about in the 20 or 30 years we'd known each other, because, you know, he'd been busy living a life, going to work, doing all of those things that we do. And there was something else then that stuck with that, that Gabor Mate said, that, you know, when we are given that news that the clock is on, the clock, I mean, we all know the clock's on, but it's quite abstract and it's a little bit intellectual. It's kind of over there. But when the clock's really on and there's no escaping it, there's something that happens to us where we start to strip away the stuff that just doesn't matter. And we just really start to focus if we give ourselves permission, and our loved ones can give us that permission. And that's why these conversations are so, so, so important. Because if we don't face the fact that the clock is on and death is coming in the fairly short term, we don't give ourselves permission to explore all of this. And I'm looking at Katie because I've actually lost my train of thought. This is a very...
No, that made perfect sense.
Did that make perfect sense?
No, because as you're saying that, I'm thinking, actually, that's exactly my experience observing people going through the process, if you like. So you have that initial, they're told the clock is ticking, you know, and that they've got this finite amount of time left. And the emotions you see are completely understandable and right. And that is one of fear, sadness, anger, even bitterness, why me, that kind of thing. All those emotions, completely understandable. But that's not where it stops, ever, I would say, or rarely, you know, is that mostly I'm astounded by people's ability to actually progress from there on to healing. Yeah. At a time when the body is not healing, physically they're not healing, emotionally, mentally, you see that healing. You do see an acceptance come. You see them healing relationships. You see them prioritizing what, you know, what's important to them, seeing friends, family. And it is, it's a time of healing. And as doctors, there's a phrase that we use, and it's not used very much now, and I think I mentioned it to you, Nick. It comes, I think, and I stand corrected if I'm wrong, from the Royal College of Physicians, I think, or the Royal College of General Practitioners. I'm not sure, but it's in Latin. And the phrase, I won't give it in Latin, but it is to that as doctors, our role is to cure sometimes, relieve often, and comfort always. To cure sometimes, you're right. Yes, sometimes there is no cure. And that's not a failure. And doctors still see that as a failure, I think. We feel like our patients shouldn't die, and yet it's the only thing that's inevitable. So sometimes we are not going to be able to cure. There isn't one. So cure sometimes, relieve often. Frequently we can provide relief, physical relief of symptoms, but mental relief, support, that sort of thing. But then the last one, comforting, comfort always. And that's where friends and relatives come in, and, you know, that everybody can be comforted. And that's why it's almost a journey to acceptance of, right, this is where I'm at, might as well get the most out of it. And people can. And I think that's why I find end-of-life care so rewarding. And I always say this, that it is quite an honour to be let into people's lives at that time. And you see the very best of people. You see them overcoming things that if you told them they were going to face before, they would have been terrified by it and said, no, I won't be able to cope with that. I can't do that, not me. And you see them handle it like a superstar, you know, like they just, we're better than we think we are, and we have it in us to heal, definitely.
Yeah, and I think that, I love that saying. When we talked about it the other week, I really, really liked that, because I think one of the things that I definitely see is that if, and this is not in any way diminishing the grief and the sadness that is a natural and very necessary part when we lose our loved ones, and which will come. But there is something I have found is when people can make peace with the fact that they are going to die, I do genuinely believe it really allows our body to do its job in the same way as, you know, I suppose it's the soul midwifery. I can't think of the word. Analogy. Thank you very much. Yes, sorry. You know, when we can allow our body to do the job of to birth the soul, that's what our body does. It naturally wants to do that. You know, we have contractions and so forth. And there is an opposite that I think that happens when we talk about the process of death. You know, it is a process. It is a labor of its own we go through. And I think movement is so key, and that fighting those phases. So when we talk about comfort, I think maybe we just need to define that comfort, because when somebody's dying, the comfort cannot be, it's going to be all right, you're not going to die. It's going to be all right. It's not going to hurt. There's nothing to be scared of. I'm sure this treatment's going to work. Science and research is moving on all the time. They'll find something before the time's there. We can fight this. I'm not sure that is always comfort in the face of something which is much bigger.
These are phrases that I have heard time and time again, and that I have said, you know, and it's really hard to stop yourself saying things like that, because you so want to offer hope and provide comfort. And yet, yeah, you're right.
And it's difficult. It's difficult, right? Because maybe when, and I read this somewhere, and it was really hard hitting, really touched my heart. Was one woman who was talking about her experience. She'd been, you know, given a very difficult diagnosis. She was relatively young, and there really wasn't going to be a cure or a happy ending in the terms of what we view as a happy ending to her story. And, you know, there were lots of people coming to see her trying to make things better. And, you know, one doctor came to see her to say, you know, we know you're struggling and you're feeling sad. Can we... you know, we can give you some medication to help with that, to help with your mood and depression. And what she writes is that, you know what I really needed? I really needed the permission and the psychological safety and the freedom to be really honest about how I was feeling and to, you know, to rage at the injustice of it, to scream with the fear of what I was feeling, to weep with the despair of, you know, leaving her children. And by doing that, she said, you know, you, there's a really famous quote. I'm sorry, everybody. You can probably tell my brain fog is quite bad in this metaphor. So, of course, I can't remember the exact words. But it goes along the lines of, you know, we assume that the tsunami, the waves of despair will drown us when very often they are what saves us. And she writes about being allowed to feel all of those things and to go through that. And being a friend and comforting means in that situation, sitting with that person and giving them the permission. So, you know, if somebody says to me, I'm really worried about dying. I feel awful about this. It's terrible. Perhaps the response, rather than trying to provide a solution or something that's not going, it's just going to sound so superficial in the face of it, is, okay, well, tell me, what's the thing that scares you the most? What's the thing that is hurting you the most? Mm-hmm. And to just give that space to people. And this woman's journey that I mentioned was just so inspiring, because that's what she was saying. And it was actually the movement of her being allowed to go through what we can often see as really, really uncomfortable. We would often refer to it, you know, as a water, I think just to, we talked last time about the soul midwifery stages, which are earth, water, fire, and air. And there is a fifth stage, which is a more spiritual, soulful stage after the passing. But through the journey of death, from a soul midwifery perspective, each of those elements withdraws from our being. And so, you know, our balance and our chakras and all kinds of things are affected. In life, we're constantly going through all of those elements, but they're replenishing, they're coming back. And it's really interesting that the movement through them, and particularly the water and fire stage, water, as you can imagine, is very emotive, very reflective. And fire is, you know, can be very angry and frustrated. It can also be, you know, hugely inspiring and full of excitement as well. But they are the two phases we probably find the most difficult to witness as we support people.
Yeah.
And we have to, I don't think it's so much the person who's dying that necessarily needs to get used to them more. I think they probably would really welcome that. I think us as comforting, as friends, as soul companions, whatever it is we want to call ourselves, we have got to get better at stepping into that space, because these are really core human traits.
And those are the conversations, where you're saying, what are you scared of? Tell me the detail. Ask me the specific questions that you don't want to ask. You know, actually, lay it all out on the table. Let's have a look at it, you know, and just say it. And the number of times I've said to patients, you're allowed to be really mad about this. This is not fair. This should not have happened to you. It is not fair. You are allowed to be mad. And you know, how mad are you? Go on, tell me. You know, how cross are you? How upset are you? How do you feel leaving your kids? You know, it's nobody really wants to hear the answer, but those are the conversations that are really healing. And they're not just healing for the person who's leaving. They're healing for you. Like, I find them healing. You know, some of these conversations are distressing to have, but, you know, they're healing.
And if you don't have them, because you're making me think, as you're saying, as those difficult questions are asked, mm-hmm. and the person is given the complete psychological safety to explore all of that, what happens is movement. And with movement, that means that you can then get to the space that says, so what is it that you need? And that's about empowering and giving people back some choice, some feeling that, you know, in a way, you know, the universe has closed the door in front of you and it's closed the door behind you. I used this saying with a friend the other day of about a certain situation. And I said, I feel like the doors have been closed either way and the choices have been reduced to such a small amount. But actually, you know, even as Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust survivor who went on to write again, the exact title I'm now struggling for, Man's Search for Meaning, Purpose. Sorry, but you know, I'm sure if you Googled that, you would get the book. Even in the face of seemingly no choice, we can find some tiny choice. And then maybe through those conversations, we can get to the point that says, okay, can we now get to a point where we go, are you starting to feel, based on what you are faced with, what it is you really need? Because I think people at the start of the journey, when they first receive a diagnosis or the thought that, there's a real possibility this is not going to be something that I get through, I think it's quite difficult to go straight to the things, the really deep things that are driving me.
The instinct at that point, I think, is to fight and to sort of fight that, by even thinking about that, kind of go into denial a bit and go, no, not me though. I can fight it. I can find a cure. I will defeat this. I can, you know, and that's a really common sort of reaction that I've seen. It's sort of, and not me though. Yeah, yeah. That's sort of denial. We just can't go there yet. You know, it's time, it's a space for the conversations to just allow things to sink in and sort of acceptance to sink in really.
Yeah, and it is a difficult one because a lot, I have to say, I think it manifests in various different ways. So one of the big ways I think it manifests, certainly it did with my own father, is food and how we nourish ourselves. And one of the, you know, early signs, I'm sure you know better than I, Katie, is that, you know, we just need less food. Our taste buds change. Our body's not able to digest in the same way. We just do not follow the same pattern. Often we can become far more tired. We need to sleep more. We can't be as mobile. You know, we don't have the energy. We don't have the motivation. And very often, you know, there's this drive, very physically focused on, you know, I've got to build myself up. I must eat. I'm not going to sleep in the day because that's somehow cheating. And I'm only going to sleep at night. And all of this, all of these really are parts of the denial, trying to hold on. Now, in terms of some of the things we're taught, which is very much about always meeting our friends where they are. Mm-hmm. You know, it's never up to us to tell anybody what stage they're at. It's just supporting them to be able to find movement in that journey.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes, I think there is definitely, even if it is a slightly disguised question or a permission seeking for us to maybe be a bit braver to say, maybe you just don't need to eat as much.
It's okay maybe, to sleep during the day.
Yeah, maybe we take that off the table because maybe this is the journey, because actually maybe we can start to have a more upfront conversation about no cure. And can we focus more on the emotional and psychological side of healing and growth? Mm-hmm. But we have to start to have this relationship and this conscious, I suppose, you know, even if we can't accept that death is imminent, it is in the room.
Yeah. Whether we like it or not, it gets particularly complicated, I think, when there are treatments there that are not curative, but so palliative treatments that are there to prolong life if we can, improve quality of life if we can. That gets tricky, I think, because sometimes you're walking a fine balance between quality of life and quantity of life. And if you're not in a great place in that journey and you're still in kind of fighting mode, there's sometimes a need to take everything offered to you. Sometimes to your detriment, you know, sometimes as you're signing yourself up for a lot of side effects, and it's that weighing up quality versus quantity of life and what your priority is. And that needs really honest conversations about where you're at in your journey? And are you ready to sort of accept, actually, I don't want any further treatments? And I had a patient do that, a younger patient, which is quite rare, because often, you know, you want to stay as long as you can and you'll take anything to prolong your life. You don't mind if it reduces your quantity. But actually, she was sort of able to say, no, I'd rather have quality of life, spend quality time with friends and family, and, you know, go when my time comes, but have a decent quality of life. But that's a very personal thing. And it doesn't really matter which of those, it doesn't matter what decision you make, as long as you've got appropriate support and, yeah, opportunity to change your mind or to, and that you're allowed to say, actually, I don't want to fight anymore.
Yeah, and I think that you are empowered to make those decisions based on very transparent and compassionate and honest conversations. And again, it was another story I was reading about this time a gentleman who was dying, and he had decided, he decided to shift his perspective because the treatments he was offered to prolong his life were pretty intrusive. And would have really affected the quality of his life. And what he said, what where he found the way forward for him was to stop thinking about the chronology, the longevity, the time of life, to stop thinking about life in terms of time, years, counting, and to start thinking about his life in terms of quality and moments and experiences. And that's how he started counting his life. And that led him to be able to find a way to make the decision not to have some of the more intrusive measures, which wouldn't have cured him. They would have prolonged life, but at a really significant cost. Now, that's not to say that anybody else should make the same decisions, but I think it's important that he made that decision on a very, very open, transparent, honest conversation with the people that were around him. And he also had and did a lot of work on himself emotionally to really dig deep into what really matters to me. What are the things that really make my heart sing, even in this landscape of, you know, despair and loss? What are the things that are most important? And I wonder if we can somehow, when we look at how we, you know, manage death, make it more holistic. So it's not just the medical side, but it is this psychological, you know, a lot of us can go our whole life and never really truly grasp the things that really matter to us, because we are so busy living a life that is full of distractions, full of fixes, full of busyness, that can be very difficult. I mean, you only have to look out there at the self-help market to see, you know, the stuff that's going on to help us all understand ourselves, which again is a little bit of an irony because it's kind of distracting ourselves from really getting to know ourselves, which I'm sure is a discussion for another day. But I wonder from a, you know, a palliative care perspective, whether we can make this more holistic, because it's not just physically what options are available to manage your illness, but psychologically, what can we do to really help you get a handle on what's really important here?
Because those conversations are not medical. And I think often people turn to the medical profession for an answer. Well, what should I do? You tell me. How well will this work? What's the evidence? How long will it give me? What side effects will it give me? And often we don't have those answers. We don't have enough experience with it. It's different for everyone. There's no certain answers by the time you get to this stage. And so it's not a medical conversation. That I'm all for doctors having those conversations, but it's not a medical decision. It's very much a personal decision. And those conversations aren't necessarily conversations to have with your doctor. They're conversations to have with friends and family and those closest to you and with yourself. You know, honest conversations about where are we at now? And is it time to fight? Is it time to stop? Is it time to, you know, yeah.
And it's interesting, as you're saying that, Katie, I suppose the whole hypothesis and fundamentals that Gabor Maté's work is based on. He's a trauma specialist and physician. Is he says one of the things that happens when you go into a physician's room, and he's studied many life-limiting diseases, is, you know, the first question is, so tell me about your symptoms. And what he argues is the first question really should be, tell me about yourself. Tell me about what's happened to you. Tell me about all of these things that go around it. You know, tell me about your life. Tell me about what's important to you. Because what he's saying is we cannot treat one facet, one part of us as a human being. And I guess as a soul midwife, that's where I'm coming from, is saying, you know, our biology and our physical being is one part, but we are so much more than the cells that make us up. We can feel that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, even when our loved ones have left this earth, and we don't get to see their physical body again, we don't get to smell them, we don't get to hear the sound of their voice, the way they walk, the way they laugh. But you know what we do? Mm-hmm. But we have it in our minds. It's an experience. It's mm-hmm. it's a thought. It's an intuition. It's an intangible feeling or connection. So of course we must be more than the cells and the blood that make us up. Yeah. And I guess that's why I find his work interesting, because I'm not saying it's one or the other. Mm-hmm. I think it's all of it. It's
all of it, yeah. Which requires all of us to be involved in the conversation. And that's the point, isn't it? Is that those conversations aren't just left to doctors. Yes, the medical profession are on hand and need to be and can be a help and a support, but it's for everyone to discuss these things even beforehand. You know, we don't have to wait till the clock is ticking to be thinking about these things and for the conversation to make a difference. You know, it's you don't have to wait till then to have these conversations.
No, and I think that part of the sooner we can have the conversations, I think the more time we have to live well. Because I think a lot of what we see when people start on their journey with death is a real focus at getting to the things that really matter. Mm. And again, I was reading somewhere that, oh, if only we could have that focus whilst we were living. If only we could have that focus and that authenticity whilst we were living and we didn't waste the time.
Well, we use the phrase living well while dying, you know, and I think actually you can probably live the best while you're dying. You know, that your focus is different, your perspective is different. And that can be something of a gift, that it gives you a different perspective that not all of us get. Maybe that's why it's so nice to be around people at that time. You come away with a completely new perspective.
I think there's a real connection, isn't there? Because it's authentic. Because when you meet somebody in the situation where they are, you know, they have life-limiting illnesses or they're entering. And I did want to actually just distinguish here, because it was something that I found really interesting from a non-medical perspective, the difference between palliative care and end of life. So palliative care is very much, correct me if I'm wrong, Katie, about living as well as we can for as long as we can.
Yes.
It's very much about quality of life. It's very much about being alive here and now. Whereas end of life is generally a much shorter period.
It's the final days.
Yes.
It's the,
And that's something that, you know, comes on from that. And I think that when you, certainly I found when I interact and I engage and spend time with people, it is such a genuine connection. It is such a loving and joyful and compassionate connection, because it's so authentic. You are connecting with that core authentic person straight away, because there just isn't room for any of the other stuff that we get
time for any rubbish.
No, there just isn't.
Or deceiving or pretending or, there's no show there.
And you know what you've made me think as well tonight is, you know, how do we kind of grow that muscle? How do we all, you know, get that courage to be able to, you know, step into that space, step into that room, step up to that person. And you know what I think it is it's not just waiting for somebody, to be at end of life. But generally, as we go through life, people have bad news, people have challenges, people can face very difficult situations. And I wonder whether we can practice more active listening without judging or feeling that we have to step in and solve and offer a solution, you know, unless it's being asked for. I wonder if we can just practice being a little bit more of that person that can actually just offer that space and be that listener, because most of us, we kind of get there, Katie, don't we?
Everybody can do it. There's no skill involved. You can't teach it. It actually, if you spend enough time with someone, it's natural.
Yeah.
It's natural. And at first it feels uncomfortable, but sit there long enough, it's natural.
Yeah.
We know what to do. The words are there. Sometimes the words aren't there, but there's a comfort there. And it is, again, it's that you can always comfort.
Yes.
Always. And we can all feel comfort always, even when we're dying.
Yeah. If we can still the mind, we can hear the heart. I love that saying. So I think that probably brings us to the end of tonight's conversation on Let's Talk About Death. We really hope that some of you will have found some comfort and some peace. We are very keen to be able to answer anybody's questions and to talk about the things that really matter to you and that you want to hear about. You can post on, you know, the Radio Newark podcast and the webpage. You can also contact me directly through my website, which is www.it's Nick Davis, which is nikdavis.com. And what I would want to reassure everybody is it's okay to ask anything that you want to ask us. It will be anonymous. We will never be sharing names or details of anybody, but we will always do our very, very best to answer the questions as best as we can. And going forward, we've got some more podcasts coming up and we will have some guest speakers. So we'll let you know on social media as we know more about that. And just to wish everybody well and hope that's been of help. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.